This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to our 20th annual Writers Symposium by the Sea at Point Loma Nazarene University. I'm Dean Nelson on the journalism faculty at the university, and we have Joyce Carol Oates with us this evening, novelist, short story writer, playwright, poet, essayist, Twitter person. I don't even know what you say about a Twitter, you know, anyway, twittist, and even an expert in boxing, which I hope we get to in just a little bit. She has won virtually every kind of literary award, including the National Book Award, for years taught creative writing at Princeton, is now teaching creative writing at Stanford. She has written more books than most people have read in their entire lives. It is a privilege to have you here with us, Joyce Carol Oates. I love that you were inspired as a little girl by reading Alice in Wonderland.
Yes, very much.
So
yes.
So what was it about that? What were you, nine?
I was about 8 or 9 years old. Well, I lived on a farm in upstate New York, and I think the Alice in the Alice book is the very antithesis of a little girl from upstate New York in a snow belt. So I was just given this book by my grandmother, whom I loved so much, and she really changed my life by giving me books basically for every birthday and Christmas. And this was a nice illustrated book that really imprinted itself just very deeply in my memory.
And this matter that she was so different, the Alice character was so different from you, but her character, in my reading, it looked like her character encouraged you to be bolder, to question authority, and to look at life as a possibility for adventure.
Yes, I think so. There may be a different tradition in American children's literature than in English children's literature, or it may simply have been that Lewis Carroll was writing a book for adults, and it's not really a book for children. But the little girl in the Alice books is extremely inquisitive. She doesn't really take no for an answer. She is adventuresome. She has the sort of boldness that real little girls of about 8 or 9 would not have. So I think that made a strong impression on me. It seemed to me a possible world that I had never had any experience with, being from this farm and knowing very little about the world.
Then an interesting transition happened, though, in regard to that book for you. After a while, you no longer were identifying with Alice. You were starting to think you wanted to be Lewis Carroll.
Well, I wanted to write and draw the little drawings. I think that all children are very creative and maybe imitative in the very beginning, and so I had these Crayolas and was drawing these figures. In my case, cats, lots of cats and chickens. And it just was...
You write what you know,
yeah. I had not yet mastered human beings, and I was sort of starting small.
But I just think that's interesting that you went from identifying with the character to identifying with the author.
Well, I think I said that in an interview or something, but I'm not sure if that's actually true. You see, you may, to prepare for your interview, you may have read some other interviews, but you know, that's one of these strange genres, because in interviews, people often just say whatever comes in their heads.
Can you anticipate my next question? Why would we believe anything you're going to tell us tonight?
That's a very good question. I think that when you ask any kind of creative artist a question, the person will try to give a plausible answer. But these wellsprings of creativity and choices that you make, as when you fall in love with someone, you basically don't have a rational answer. These are things... If you're being honest, you don't really know, but you give a plausible answer.
Well, this is going to be fun.
Well, I'm a professor at an Ivy League university, so I've learned to do plausible answers.
When you were in high school, you wrote a bunch of novels that you then threw away.
Yes.
What was so bad about them, or why were you so self-conscious about them?
Well, I was probably sort of unconsciously doing apprentice work. It's like playing scales on a piano or doing your piano lessons and practicing. I remember being very influenced by Scott Fitzgerald, very influenced by Hemingway and Faulkner. Those are the three great influences when I was in high school. And a couple of the stories, the Hemingway influence stories, actually got published in high school literary magazine. So sometimes when I go out and give readings or visit a college, somebody will have bought these little magazines, like a junk shop or someplace, and they say, "Oh, Miss Oates, will you sign this?" And I really want to get it. You know, I want to buy them all up and hide them.
Why? I mean, were they just awful, or do you have any regrets about that now? Just think about, wow, you might have been onto something way back.
Well, I don't really know what you mean by awful. It's a relative term. You know, many people are self-conscious and wincing about work that they've done when they were younger. It may not really be that bad. It just be that you just sort of, you know, you don't want to look at it.
Is this when you were also reading, like, comic books like Tales from the Crypt and Mad Magazine?
Well, I was reading the comic books maybe at an earlier age. I probably stopped reading when I started reading Wittgenstein in high school.
Seriously? Wittgenstein in high school?
Seriously? Of course. If you're reading Wittgenstein in high school, you're serious. I mean,
yeah.
By definition, you're not fooling around. No, but I think probably Mad Magazine stayed with me a little longer. That was a really revolutionary and very exciting subversive magazine. Little did we know that it was sort of just casting a mirror, turning a mirror on life. I thought it was an exaggerated comic book. Not at all.
It's some pretty significant
satire. It's just like, you know, Stendhal said the mirror is holding, a novel is a mirror on the roadway. It's sort of what Mad Magazine is in terms of the United States.
Huh. That, I wish I would have thought of that when my parents were after me about reading.
Well, we just keep learning all these subsequent things. You know, as years go by, you learn about things that were going on when you were younger. Like I just read the other day, maybe it was just yesterday, that the, quote, missile gap was some sort of fabrication. Now, my generation grew up with, you know, the threat of the missile gap was very real. Do you remember that?
Oh, sure, sure.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that was just a fabrication. It was sort of like something that was leaked to the press, and it was something that came out of Washington, but it was not ever really real.
That we had fewer weapons than the bad guys.
The Russians didn't really have very many weapons. It was sort of trumped up and exaggerated to make the population feel anxious and to feel that the authority in Washington was, you know, really very, very powerful.
Isn't that interesting? That's never happened since.
Oh, that never happens. But if I think I remember, like the Sputnik and the missile gap in the Cold War, that there was this great threat. But evidently, according to what historians are now revealing, it was exaggerated.
When you were in college, you submitted an essay or a story to Mademoiselle magazine. They had a
short story.
Short story, a writing contest.
Yes.
And you won.
I did win it. Yeah, and a few years earlier, though I didn't know this, Sylvia Plath had won. So there was a tradition of strange young women winning this award. But I didn't know that. I didn't know who she was. She hit at that moment, you know, at that time, and she wasn't yet famous.
Well, did that give you some confirmation that this is something that you really want to be pursuing, winning a contest like that?
I don't really know how to answer that. I never have had great expectations about the future. And maybe that's just my personality. Yesterday, one of the students at Stanford said, "Well, what do you expect?" They're handing their portfolios in a few weeks. What do you expect, you know? And I suddenly thought, I don't really have any expectations at all. You know, so I'll see what you do, and I'm probably going to be happy and interested in what you do. But the idea of having expectations is kind of an interesting ontological issue. You know, like, if you have too many expectations, it's somewhat paralyzing and crippling, maybe. So I probably have never had very many expectations. I would have thought it was fantastic and incredible that I won this competition, but I wouldn't therefore think that I would win anything else or even be published. I wouldn't necessarily extrapolate for the future.
Oh, okay. You know, I'm thinking you also, I mean, you mentioned Hemingway and Faulkner and Fitzgerald, but didn't you also read Edgar Allan Poe when you were younger?
Well, I read a lot of different things. When I was fairly young, I read Henry David Thoreau. I think that helped, along with Lewis Carroll, to form my personality, such as it is, you know. And Edgar Allan Poe is a little different. Poe has different voices. One of them is a very contemporary kind of voice in The Tell-Tale Heart. It almost could be written today. But then his more characteristic voice is very turgid with long paragraphs and very formal 19th century prose. And probably that, I would have had difficulty making my way through that. So I wouldn't say that Poe was a strong influence. But I always did really much admire Henry David Thoreau.
The reason I asked about Poe is I just wondered if his writing had some impact on some of the topics that you choose and some of the things that you have people thinking about in their head and in their heart. Because, I don't know, it looks like those could be linked.
Well, influences are myriad, you know, especially for somebody who's read a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, one can be influenced by any number of, like, 1,400 books, and it's hard to say. We're also deeply influenced by our experiences. The deep emotional experiences of our lives are what shape us as people and as writers. And the literary influences may be formal. They may show you a way of organizing your material. But it's this deep experiences, these unconscious, the sort of resonance that's unconscious that determines what we will write.
Okay. You know, one reviewer said about your work that you were our poet laureate of schizophrenia, blasted childhood, and random acts of violence. Does that seem accurate?
Again, I don't really know what to say about that. First of all...
Say something plausible, Joyce.
I would wonder whether the person even knows what schizophrenia means. That's a much misunderstood and, you know, cliche word. It's just somebody writing, you know. I'm not sure that it's that relevant to me, you know. Are there more quotes there?
I have plenty. Yeah. But there are so many themes in your writing that I just kept picking up on in all short stories or your essays or your novels. There's racism. There's alienation. There's poverty, sex, feminism, serial killers, family disintegration, criminality, greed, fame, and celebrity.
I'm sure you've left something out. Roller skating.
Yeah, but that isn't a theme. Roller skating wasn't a theme.
It is in upstate New York.
All right.
It was part of my childhood.
Right, right. But all of the stories you write seem to have these underlying things of that list that I just gave you.
I really write about people. I write about human beings, people who react to one another, and some of these issues are sort of peripheral, but most writers write about people, not writing about, you know, sexism or sex or violence. I mean, you can't exactly write about violence. You have to write about people. And usually they have, there's a story, you know, there's not violence in every sentence, but they're doing other things, and there's a little story, and they undergo some transformations, and maybe they come out stronger than they were before. So I think most writers are interested in telling stories about human beings, and the themes that people see in the work sometimes are surprising to the writers.
What has surprised you about what people have found in what you've done?
Well, Faulkner, for instance, said he writes about the truths of the human heart. And probably that's what most writers would say. They're writing some perspective, that their perspective about truths of the human heart. And if you're Faulkner, then you are writing about the American South, you know, writing defeat of the Confederacy, you're writing about racism and so forth, because that's part of your story of your life. And but basically it's about the human dilemma. that we yearn for so much that we can't really realize, mm-hmm. that we love people and we want to protect and save them, but we have to relinquish them. Eventually we lose everything, and eventually we die ourselves. And this great mystery is so profound that it's a story that people keep telling over and over and over again in different ways, because it's the human story.
You know, what you mentioned Faulkner. A couple of your books really felt like Faulkner for this reason, that you were getting inside the head and motive and backstory and point of view from all of the different characters in a story. And you're the only one besides him that in my view, that do this so well. Usually a story comes from a particular point of view, there's a narrator or something like that. But you're telling the same story from all of these different perspectives. I just think it's an amazing talent.
Well, I'm very interested in human personality and different voices. So for me, it's an exciting idea to take one episode, you know, and then there are different people who witness it from their different perspectives, and they see it somewhat differently, though it's the same thing, and they have different voices. To me, that's just very exciting to hear different people speaking. I try to really bury my own narrative voice sort of in the background, so allowing the characters to speak.
You know, in the book The Faith of a Writer, you say your forbidden passions are likely to be the fuel for your writing. Your forbidden passions as the fuel. Can you expand on that? I think I know what you mean, but can you expand on that?
Well, when we're driven to write or create a movie or do paint a picture or something, emotions for this are very deep. Mm-hmm. I don't think they can be superficial, because you'd lose interest in it. So it has to come from some deep experience. It may be one of woundedness. There's some feeling that you have been wounded, or that you're an outsider, and that is a drama about being on the outside and looking at people on the inside. And these stories people start to write to maybe alleviate some of the stress and tension of being in those positions. But then in writing the stories, if they're written beautifully and compellingly, they become very successful and part of a community, so the person is kind of drawn into the community. That's an interesting consequence of being an artist. Probably every filmmaker you know, and every artist and every writer, starts off somewhat feeling like an outsider, but as time goes on, maybe part of the community, may even become a spokesman for the community. So that's a kind of wonderful development.
But what do you mean about the forbidden passions?
Well, forbidden passions could be something very venal, trivial. People don't want to write about being jealous or envious. Those seem like diminishing. But if you're writing a novel, you have characters doing all sorts of different things, and one of them might be envy or jealousy. And so you can give it a real spark and a real sympathy, because everyone has these emotions. And so some people don't want to talk about it, but if they read a novel or see a movie about it in which it's dramatized in a very sympathetic way, then I think that sort of draws us all into this, what I call the human predicament or human dilemma.
You know, in that same book, The Faith of a Writer, you've got two sentences that I just thought you have just summed up why we do what we do. The first sentence was, the writer's first thought is, I have to tell. And the second thought is, how do I tell it?
That's right. Yeah, how do you do it? That's a challenge.
So I mean, you've experienced this, though. I mean, whether it's something you've seen or a news account that you read, or like in your Boston Globe piece this morning, where you're talking about the driver getting pulled over, driving while black, basically, and being harassed by the police. And your response is, I have to tell this, right?
Yes, I have written a good deal about race situations, sometimes from the point of view of a white person, sometimes from the point of view of a black person. To me, I really grew up, since I was about the age of 12 or 13, very interested or fascinated by this division in the United States. But since Ferguson, Missouri, last August, it's become such a conscious thing in the culture now, which is really wonderful. But I think there are many, 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 many white people, great majority of white people are not racist at all. You know, but the racism is almost like a toxic cloud of invisibility. And we don't know there's racism going on. It's hurting fellow Americans, but it doesn't hurt us, so we don't see it. And that's why the social media in particular has been so revolutionary and wonderful in bringing this to the attention of well-intentioned white people don't really know how bad it is with other citizens. Now we know a lot more, and police brutality and so forth. I have to say I really didn't know much. I didn't know much about this when I was growing up. I'm sure it was going on, of course, but we didn't really know much. You know, you put the television on, there were only three network channels, and everything was censored. But we weren't really aware of that. So, and newspapers were just, you know, dealing with news that was fit to print. So a lot of us in my generation really grew up not knowing a lot that was going on.
So walk us through your thinking in one of your books, and I'm thinking in particular the one that just came out, The Sacrifice, and apply this I have to tell and how do I tell it kind of thing. I assume that somewhere along the line, the Tawana Brawley story from the 80s was still percolating in your head after it had occurred, and you're still wanting to write about racism at some point. I mean, your book Them being such a that precursor to the race riots in Detroit. So at what point were you thinking with that book, that's a story I have to tell?
Well, I had always wanted to write a novel from the point of view of a black family. I had lived in Detroit at the time of the riot. In 1967, that was a long time ago. Many people were not born yet. There's always a little ripple of terror when you mention it. People say, "What?" I didn't quite hear that. You know? But it was July 1967, and my husband at that time and I were in the house only about two blocks away from looting and burning, and there were sirens and gunshots. And we sort of huddled in this house in Detroit in a residential neighborhood. And it was very shocking, and it's like being in a war zone. And as time went on, after that I remember the emotions very well. I really wanted to write about that experience, like what led up to it, and what caused it to erupt that night, and down in 12th Street in the inner city of Detroit. Why was it that night? What was going on? So I wrote a novel called Them, which is about white people. But at the time, which is 1970, there wasn't really much known. But as the decades have gone by, there have been many, many books about what's called civic disorder in the United States, which usually means some sort of a riot that might be attributed to race and police brutality and so forth. These civic disturbances all around the country have been written about, and so I was able to do research and know a lot more about the city I was living in. I didn't know that much about it. And so this time I wanted to write about a black family. So therefore, the Sacrifice is that novel. Then the Tawana Brawley case seemed a very appropriate plot to connect with that theme, because it was a tabloid phenomenon, which many people today have probably forgotten. But it was an event. It was almost like a non-event because it was a hoax. It didn't happen, you know. It didn't happen, but it got into the media, and then one thing led to another, and all these articles and tabloid and New York Times and so forth, it just became like a huge snowball, and it got enormous, and yet there was nothing actually to it. So I wanted to write about that phenomenon, how the media could take something and trump it up and exaggerate it, even though probably some of the people in the media might have known. I mean, they might have guessed that it wasn't authentic. So part of writing the novel was to deal with the media, and there are some chapters where the media is. Because the media at the time, I think, they were considering that this would sell newspapers, that there was something about the case that will cause people to buy newspapers. And there's that motive of sensational tabloid journalism. Oh, you're a journalist. And
I was just about to warn you that now you're getting personal.
Well, let me put it this way. Say you're an editor of a great newspaper, or you're running a really, really popular news program on network television. So you have this footage, which is horrific, of people beheading innocent victims and so forth. Now, what do you do with that? Mm-hmm. Do you show that? Well, or do you not show that? I mean, do you talk about it? Do you show pictures of it? Do you show corpses? Or do you not do that? Because if you don't do that, your competitors are going to do it. They're going to run away, and they're going to put all the lurid images on. So I'm just curious. I really wonder, like, I don't know any answer, so it's not a trick question. I honestly don't know what an ethical position would be today. We didn't have those problems in the past because virtually everything was censored. You'd never see anything like that on television in the past.
Yeah, this is the freedom that a novelist has. If you're asking me to respond to that, I will. But this is the freedom that a novelist has that a journalist doesn't have to. We can't think about that. You get to create this whole world that goes around
it. It's a whole world. Also, it's a book, and a book has a very limited audience compared to network television, let's say.
Yeah.
Well, it is kind of ethical. It is an ethical issue.
Of course it is.
But it's also a commercial issue, because if you don't do it, you know very well somebody else is going to do it.
But social media have flattened that competition, because if you don't see it in the New York Times or you don't see it in one of the tabloids, you're going to see it on somebody's website.
So what is that answer then? I really don't know the answer. I wouldn't want to have a newspaper. I wouldn't want to publish those images myself.
Yeah,
do you do? I mean, I have a black image or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, since this is about you and not about me, let's move on. All right?
Well, it's about ethical issues in literature, maybe, in journalism. I'm very interested in these issues, because where does the right of the individual to express himself or herself, does that override, in some cases, a collective, a common will, sense of decency in the community? Or, these issues are always with us, and some communities are much more censorious, others are much more liberal and open. I don't think there's any one answer, actually.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I'm going to take us a different direction here. I've got to tell you that my whole being relaxed when I read this line I spend most of my time looking out the window.
Well, that's
I just
true.
Thought, you mean I've been working this whole time and I didn't even know it.
Yes, I do look out the window a lot. It's very important to me to have a view out the window. And you have some great views around here, I must say. It's fantastic.
But this is, for you, though, this is part of the creative process. Walking, running, looking out the window.
That's what I say to myself. I might just be looking out the window. Now we have this fantastic place on Panoramic Hill in Berkeley. And so we have a view going down toward San Francisco and the bay, and we can see the Golden Gate Bridge, and a fantastic, ever-shifting display of light and color as the sun sets. It's quite mesmerizing. Then closer in are eucalyptus trees, and all sorts of Steller's jays, which are not known in the east. And we have blue jays in the east. You have Steller's jays here, and they're all flipping around. And then it must be mating season for the squirrels, because the squirrels are everywhere. And they're big, bushy, red-tailed, red squirrels that are just scampering all around and clattering over the roof. And one of them, or maybe it's not always the same one, he's always looking in the window at me. He's sort of wondering, like, am I a squirrel? What's he looking for? You know, he's kind of looking with his little eyes. So I spend a lot of time dealing with all this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
it's important work.
Yeah, I'm just sitting down to my work, and I hear the click, and it's a squirrel. He's wondering what I'm doing. I guess it's mating season, and he couldn't find a real squirrel or something. He's there every morning. I don't want to disappoint him, but
yeah.
I'm not going out.
I think you need to think more highly of yourself than that.
Well, I'm not going out with that squirrel. We'll get that settled. I didn't go out to meet the squirrel. I stayed in. I did my little work.
Maybe the squirrel's a writer, and he's just killing time looking in your window.
I think that might be possible. They're running all around the roof. It's just so bizarre. Yeah.
All right, so looking out the window notwithstanding, you're a pretty disciplined writer. And I just think it's really interesting that you can get the work done, and yet a lot of the characters you write about are these chaotic individuals. They're just sort of the not you.
Well, I give the impression of being disciplined, which is what all you have to do, you know. You just
give the impression?
Give the impression of being a disciplined, yes.
So you're really not? This is just all a...
Well, I take care of my husband a good deal. Mm-hmm. I take care of this when I'm home. I take care of the cat. You know, I do all these things, and then if there's any time left over, then I work on my own writing. But I might stay up late. I mean, I do find some time.
I'm wondering how events from your past have helped shape some of the things you've written. Something like your grandfather was murdered, or at least that was the story you were told, or something like that. Does that play in somehow into your kind of imagination? Or you were attacked when you were a little girl in elementary school or something like that? Do those things play in, and those kinds of emotions play in when you're writing about stuff like this?
Well, I think many families have secrets and things that are not exactly discussed openly among children. So children aren't aware of something that, you know, happened right at the periphery of your vision. And I think I was well aware of that, but I didn't really know specifically that my mother's father had been murdered. I didn't know that till I was quite an adult. Mm. But I think that I probably had a sense of there being something not quite right. And my mother had then been given away because she was from a large family of 9 children. She was just a baby. She wasn't even 1 year old. Consequently, because my grandfather had been killed, she was given away to a childless couple. So the whole trajectory of that family was broken by the death of the father. And then my mother was put in a different home. And so she had a new story. Basically, she had a new life. She was with a childless couple, so she was their only child, whereas with the other, she would have been one of 9 children. So she had like a different identity. And my brother and I, of course, were born to my mother in that new identity. So I think that these many crimes and acts of violence are enacted in among our ancestors or our older relatives. They may not tell you about it. You may not know about it, but some great disappointment, or your mother was viciously treated by her first lover or something, so she married somebody else. You know, there are all these stories that probably you'll never know, but they're kind of all at the boil, you know. And so I think I have been influenced by many of these things. Hmm. And I love to write about that. I love to write about how something that seems like a crime in one generation, as it works out, it wasn't that bad. The consequences were not going to be ultimately that bad for the younger people. It actually turned out to be like a happy story.
Like what? Give me an example of something that would have been viewed as so horrific.
Well, I was just saying, because my mother was given away from a family very poor, a family not so poor. Then we were born, and and I went to college, and I mm-hmm. became a professor. I don't think probably if my mother had stayed in that other family, very, very poor, huge family, I don't think it would have been the same story. Of course, I wouldn't have been born, so it's irrelevant. But if you trace these family stories and junctures in your life that seem like a bad event, if you look back at it from another point of view, maybe it was good, you know, that things turned out therefore, and then this happened, and this happened, and then this happened. And it actually turns out to be pretty good. It's like what's called grace, you know, that sort of working in some invisible way. We don't really know what word to give it. But it's not necessarily a negative thing. It may seem that way superficially. So I actually write about that quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I don't use the word grace, but I'm thinking about that. Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of experiences like that in my own life. And like you think you're in control and you think that this is happening in this way, but you're just sort of knocked over because something else happens. But then later on, you pick yourself up and down here, and consequently something very amazing and profound was waiting for you that you wouldn't have known about if you hadn't been knocked down, you know. So I think that happens to so many people. That's something a little hard to talk about. And maybe many people, like in this room, have not really thought about it. But if you analyze it, you might see that applies to you. And then you could write a novel about that, about the mysterious workings of some sort of fate, even though the superficial, like you mentioned, all those things like mm-hmm. violence and all that, mm-hmm. those are like the superficial things. But I'm really writing about, as I said before, like the truths of the human heart that are sort of deeper. So the violence in a play like Hamlet, particularly in Macbeth, there's a lot of violence, and there's a fair amount of violence in Othello and King Lear also. The acts of violence are more or less on the surface, but the deeper changes in personality are beneath the surface, and that's why that's a work of art. I mean, King Lear is a great work of art, not because of the things on the top, but because of the deeper and compelling transformations of Lear.
Let's talk about art for a minute, because you have said that the most powerful moral art is not the kind that preaches goodness, but the kind that shows the sickening, corrosive effect of various kinds of evil. That's the most powerful moral art?
Well, I probably went on to say that people deal with it. People confront evil. They're not annihilated by it.
Yeah, well, okay, so that my question was going to be, what's the matter with moral art being about goodness?
Well, art by itself usually has some sort of conflict. Unless you're going to paint something like Mondrian's beautiful but static canvases, you have to have some sense of disequilibrium. Art's about disequilibrium. It's all conflict. You can't have three really nice people sitting in a living room for your play, and they're really, really nice people, and they're nice, and they say nice things to each other. The audience is going to walk out because the audience. I'm not saying that the audience wants blood. It doesn't have to be like a Tarantino film, but you have to have conflict. The basis of art is conflict.
Well, and you've said that it has this transgressive kind of quality to it, that it's supposed to be evocative and maybe even get you in some trouble.
It sometimes gets the artist into trouble. Many artists have gotten in a lot of trouble.
But you say that's part of
It's part
the deal.
Of what you have to accept. Yes, there are parts of the world today where if you write even a fairly innocuous novel or story, you could be locked up. I mean, you could just be taken away because they don't have freedom of expression. They don't have the tradition of freedom of speech. And it's considered bizarre that we have that tradition. Other parts of the world think that we're crazy to have it. I remember before the fall of the Berlin Wall, I was part of a delegation, met people from Soviet Russia and some Russian satellites. And they were translators and writers. But they were really, I think, many of them were spies. I mean, they were basic party hacks. And they were saying to us, Edward Albee was there, I think Kurt Vonnegut, Bill Steyer, and John Updike. And Susan Sontag, and they were saying to us, you know, why would you imagine that we should have freedom of that our dissidents should have freedom? And we were talking about the dissidents, like the Soviet dissidents, and how they should not be put in prison. But they thought we were actually somewhat bizarre. You know, we're sort of looking like a reverse mirror. And it was an interesting question. I remember this person asking me seriously. He says, why would you think that this person is a writer? He's a political person and he's a traitor or something like that. Hmm. And we were saying, well, no, these are writers. These are poets and writers. You allow them to write. But they were saying, no, they're against the regime or something. And it was kind of interesting to see this clash of ideology where we definitely felt we were right, but they seemed to think they were right too. It was really, really upsetting. It comes down to the tyranny of ideology and how people can be so cruel and so vicious to one another just armed with an ideology. I mean, I think in America we do have this tradition of freedom of speech. It's true that we are not always as egalitarian and open as we should be, but we have the tradition. We do have the Constitution. And some of these other countries have nothing like that.
Do you think it's our job as writers to transform culture?
Well, I think writers, like all artists, are all individuals. Some people are by nature rather messianic, and they want to preach and they want to have an effect upon a community. Others are more retiring and private, like Emily Dickinson, who's like the greatest poet, and Walt Whitman. Between Emily and Dickinson and Walt Whitman, I think that's the whole 19th century. And Walt Whitman was much more somebody who would like to reach out to an audience and sort of preach and tell people what to think. And Emily Dickinson would just withdraw and write these beautiful poems, and you read them and you get a strong sense of mystery and the enigmatic nature of life. But she's not preaching. She's not standing out there preaching. So I think people have different personalities. Hmm. And sometimes we have one and sometimes we have the other.
I want to go back to the sacrifice for a minute. The reviewer in the New York Times didn't think much of the sacrifice.
I think that she was basically defending her own territory.
All right, well, you can explain that in a second. But as I understood her review, this was almost a, why would a white woman write from the perspective of a race or a gender or an economic class that wasn't her own? She was just kind of challenging why you would create these kinds of points of view, right? Which is what you've been doing your entire writing life.
Oh, well, that's true. But I think there's such a thing as identity politics. And people who believe in identity politics don't think that one should be able to write about anything other than oneself. So I think that literature and art are very open just to the imagination. So if Shakespeare wants to write about a woman or a black man or an elderly person, I think that's great. To me, that's what art is, or Faulkner writes about black people. But I have often written about people very different from myself.
Right.
So it just seemed that somebody just didn't believe in that. But I think that most of us don't feel that we should just write only about ourselves. It's be very narrow.
Gets a little old after a while, doesn't it?
Well, it's an ideology. It's a political ideology. There have been very radical people in all, say, radical feminism. I'm certainly a feminist. But radical feminism at some point, perhaps not now, would say that men probably shouldn't write about from the point of view of women. But, I mean, I would not say that. This is a position that I've heard people say. I don't think that's true, but some people believe these things passionately because they are ideologues.
Well, and you took a bold move by replying in print to that reviewer. And essentially, I think you said, you know, that you didn't write the book she wanted you to write, right?
Well,
you wrote the book you wanted to write, not the book she wanted you to write.
Well, I don't think ordinarily one should respond to reviews, but I felt it was so unfair because she hadn't actually read the New York State grand jury report on the Tawana Brawley case. She hadn't read the basic primary document, and if she had, she would have known my novel was completely different. So she was chiding me for writing about something that actually I wasn't writing about. So I just thought, if you're writing for the New York Times, you should do the basic research. You know, like...
Noted.
And it would only take an hour. It wasn't that hard to do the research. I found it quite fascinating to read the grand jury report. I was very surprised by what I read, actually. And I think that many people who think they know what an issue is, if they read a little bit about it or read a court transcript, they discover that it's a little different from what the newspapers had been led you to believe. So when I wrote my novel, I made sure it was very different from that, because my novel's fiction, it's not about that. But the reviewer didn't know that because she hadn't read that. So she just sort of attacked me for some... Anyway, it was just one of these situations where, unfortunately, a reviewer hadn't gone just a little farther, gone that little extra 5 inches, you know, to do a little research.
You know, speaking of feminism, oh my gosh, some of the things that were said about women writers back when you were getting started, I'm just remembering one headline in particular from the Detroit Free Press. Detroit housewife writes a play.
Yeah, it seems amazing.
Did you just boil when you saw that?
You know, it's amazing and it seems amusing now. I don't know that I had any strong feeling. I was probably just bemused. Housewife, well.
You were a college professor.
I was a university professor at the point, yeah. But much later than that, I mean, really quite a bit later than that. I remember People magazine did a whole story on me, and this was actually like 10 years later. And I was a full professor at that point, and I had a large lecture hall. And the reporter actually came to the lecture. But then when it came to the actual magazine, an editor makes up the headlines, you know, mm-hmm. It's not the writer. As you know well. So the headline was Shy Faculty Wife.
Because seriously, it said Shy Faculty Wife?
Well, my husband was,
right.
was a professor.
But so were you.
Well, I was a professor too, but I was the shy faculty wife, even though this person had seen me giving my lecture and so forth. It's just the way women had these things said about them.
Somebody even wrote that at one interviewer said that you write like a man. What does that even mean?
Norman Mailer said that. I think it was Norman Mailer.
Well, he was certainly comfortable with his identity, wasn't he?
Well, I like Norman Mailer very much. He was just brimming with male chauvinism. It was just so exuded, the whole macho, that it was almost endearing because he had no hypocrisy. I mean, other people might pretend to be feminist or, you know, so forth. Not Norman. He just basically... But it was so much the case that it actually sort of turned around, you know, and he did like my writing. He introduced me at Lincoln Center one evening, and he was just going on and on about my book on boxing, and he said, it was so good, I thought I'd written it myself. And it was really, as I said, it was really sort of endearing, and then he got all this laughter, and he didn't know why people were laughing, you know, it's just, yeah.
Well, let's talk about boxing for a second. You became an expert in boxing, writing about it, and two of your observations about boxing have stayed with me. One is that boxing is primarily about being and not giving hurt. About being and not giving hurt. Well, that sounded to me like just living, right? That's a lot like just trying to get through your existence, isn't it? So there was a great parallel there.
Well, I wrote a lot about boxing. I've said many different things about boxing. And my feelings about it probably have evolved in different ways. It's very complex. I never thought of boxing as a sport. I thought of boxing as almost like theater of cruelty and cultural drama of some kind, almost like tragedy, Greek tragedy. I never thought of it as a sport. Now, the Golden Gloves and amateur boxing are much obviously sports. And a boxer like Mike Tyson didn't do well in amateur boxing because his strengths and his particular skills are of a great fighter, a warrior, whereas the sportsman like arena of Golden Gloves rewards a different kind of boxing rather than a fuller kind of aggressive fighting.
One of the other things you said about it, though, was I thought was so profound, was that boxing reminds us that we are primitive beings, not spiritual beings.
Well, that's true, I'm sure. The deepest experiences are physical.
Keep talking about that.
Well, like dying, being hit. I have many different thoughts about boxing. And as I said, my thoughts evolve. And I was just thinking this morning, you know, that the greatest boxers with the greatest heart, like Muhammad Ali is a profound example, they're the boxers who actually go a little too far. And it's very easy to quit when you're ahead. When you're a champion, then to retire, as Rocky Marciano did. And he never was defeated at all, you know, and that's kind of a wonderful record. But it's maybe, when you look upon it from a different perspective, it's a boxer like Muhammad Ali who went too far, and he risked so much, and his doctor was, one of his doctors resigned and wouldn't work with him anymore because he told him not to box. He kept on boxing. That maybe a really great champion is one who will go until he can't go any farther. And I realize I'm talking in a kind of mystical or exaggerated way. I mean, maybe it's not even true. It's just something that I thought of this mm-hmm. morning, that a person will want to play it safe, but a great boxer is one who goes just a little farther, and maybe he will be hurt, and maybe it was not a wise decision, but it was not a safe decision. So it was something maybe analogous to taking on a creative project that's really enormous and difficult, instead of doing a simple, clear, clean, and short thing that you know you can do, to take on some large, challenging project. So maybe that's what I was thinking of.
You know, you described the process of writing a novel as obsession, excitement, anxiety, then melancholy when done, and fear that nothing will ever mean that much again. Well, do you still feel that way about writing novels?
Well, I like writing on a daily basis, and there's a lot of satisfaction in writing. And probably I was just being a little funny in that, because there's a lot of positive satisfaction. I mean, it isn't all just these negative things. Yeah, I do miss some novels that I really put a lot of my life into. And when I think back on them, I sort of wish that I was writing them again, or that I could go back and inhabit that time in my life again. But of course, it all moves on, and you can't do that.
So let's try to give some advice to people in the audience, people watching this, people who think they want to be writers. What do you want to tell them?
Well, a real writer, a real artist, never really wants any advice at all.
Okay, thanks.
I mean, what advice would you give Picasso? What advice would you give Hemingway? I think people pretend to want advice, you know. I'm a young writer and I want advice. It's just sort of like you're being friendly or courteous or something. Secretly, you're thinking, I don't really need any advice. But the most general and harmless advice you can give a young writer is to do a lot of reading and talk to different people and let people talk and just have a lot of different experiences. This is the bedrock of writing, is having experiences and listening to people. There's no particular secret to it.
What about taking criticism, though? You've taken your fair share. Do you have any things? Do you think you have a pretty thick skin by now?
Well, that's an interesting question, too. When you think of the great writers, some of them are extremely sensitive. Some of them seemed indifferent. And yet, it doesn't seem to affect the actual writing. I think many writers feel that if they read a vicious review or even a mildly negative review, it will sap their energy and they won't have the enthusiasm for working. It's like being hit in the stomach. You just don't have the... You know, you don't have the energy. And that may be very well the case for everybody. Some people just don't read any reviews, even the good reviews. I have several friends who never read reviews. They never read even a good review. I don't read a lot of reviews. I know when I go out and I'm interviewed, some people will quote a review to me and say, what do you think of this horrible review? And I actually haven't read it, you know, and the first I hear about it is from the interviewer. So I often don't read the reviews, even if they're good reviews. I think, well, that's really nice, and I'm happy that if that's so, I'm happy about it, but I don't really want to read it. But one of the writers in classical American history, literary history, is the most sensitive was Hemingway. He's extremely sensitive to criticism. I mean, really, really sensitive to criticism, even though he was a great writer and had written great work and probably knew he was a great writer. But yet, he was very vulnerable. So it would be better for him not to know about it. He got in actual fights with people. I mean, he actually hit people.
Have you done that?
Oh, no.
All right. Now, do you feel like it tonight? Are you ready to hit me?
No, I just don't have that kind of personality.
All right.
I'm more resigned. It's depression or anger, I guess. And many women are just inclined to depression. Men are inclined to blind rage, you know. Just throwing the fists around, and women are kind of shrinking back. No, that's just be facetious.
You did make some huge generalizations
right there. I make huge generalizations. But I don't see much purpose to that, and no, not at all. I write reviews myself, and I try to temper. If I'm disappointed in a book, I basically don't want to write the review, so I tell the editor that I can't write the review. But I try to temper it, and it's all subjective, really. Mm-hmm. James Joyce got horrible reviews. His first book was burnt. You know, his first book, Dubliner, is a beautiful book. It was burnt in Dublin, as appropriate, was actually burnt, you know, so that was a pretty bad review that he got.
What's the Henry James quote that you have on your desk?
Oh, we work in the dark, we do what we can, our doubt is our passion, and our passion is our task. The rest is the madness of art.
That's good.
That's beautiful.
That is beautiful. Joyce Carol Oates, thank you so much for being with us.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.